Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
That is indeed our live studio telephone number. Last time until the 29th of May. So this is your opportunity, 877-753-3341, for all of the many, many people who are just absolutely convinced about how uncharitable I am and how inaccurate and all the misrepresentations. Now is your opportunity, a live audience listening as you demonstrate with great erudition and documentation all of the errors of that silly bald man who gains 100 pounds just to intimidate his opponents. Just, man, I tell you, the silliness that masquerades under the guise of apologetics out there. I'm sorry?
You're a bodybuilder, too.
Well, I was, but I didn't gain 100 pounds. Sorry, folks. And just to intimidate people, too. Yeah, that's the only reason I did that. But anyways.
You and Arnie, when you stand next to each other,
oh, man,
out.
I'll tell you. Yeah. Oh my, there's some interesting stuff out there. But especially the great day of prayer and fasting tomorrow for my conversion. I wonder when the Mormons are going to do that, and the I don't think Jehovah's Witnesses do prayer and fasting. and the Muslims just do it a different way, so I'm not sure how that's going to work, but oh goodness. Well, anyway, the sad thing is the majority of the people on the Catholic Answers forums don't even know that I deal with those other groups. So, you know, they just think I sit around all day, you know, throwing darts at pictures of the Pope or something. It's, you know, and if someone said that, they'd probably go, "He does? Oh, that's terrible, but I must believe it." It's just amazing. But anyway, 877-753-3341. Frank Beckwith has done an interview with Christianity Today. I'm not sure how they worked this one out. And I saw someplace else this morning a statement from him saying, "Hey, don't take that interview as the final word. I'm going to write a book on why I converted to Rome." Yeah, I'm sure you are. And Ignatius, you know, the sad thing is Erdmans will publish it. You bet. Erdmans, Baker, it doesn't matter. Somebody, you know, they'll, "Oh, hey, no problem, Frank. We'll do that. We'll put that out for you." And here's one paragraph. "I still consider myself an evangelical, but no longer Protestant." The term evangelical, have I not said for a couple years now, it's like saying I'm a human. That's the descriptive power of the term evangelical has been diluted down to the point where, whether you're a Roman Catholic, Mormon, I mean, look at what's going on with Mormonism. I mean, I was mentioning today, I was listening to Rush Limbaugh, I was listening to Sean Hannity, and, you know, "Stop talking about Romney's religion. It's irrelevant. They're just different kind of Christians. You know, there's just a slight little theological difference." Yeah, it's called the difference between monotheism and polytheism. But the level of discernment even amongst, conservative, obviously being a political conservative does not have any impact whatsoever on your spiritual status. And so, you know, if you can't even tell the difference, and you get shouted down in our society for saying, "Excuse me, but Mormons believe that God is an exalted man from the planet, lives on a planet that circles a star named Kolob, okay, and he has many wives, and we are his spiritual offspring, and he himself was once a man, and there are many gods before him, and this is the most polytheistic religion I've ever heard of, and oh, come on, they're just Christians." You know, this kind of thing. You just go, Okay, well, discernment isn't doing real well these days on any level in our society. It's just, it's amazing.
I'm waiting for somebody to call in and, you know, ask these guys, would you vote for somebody who thinks that they can become a god?
Yeah, well, but you're not allowed to ask those questions because he's a nice guy, he's a conservative, and you're doing what they did to Kennedy about the Pope and stuff like that. Well, you know, okay, I can see a parallel. The difference being that at least Roman Catholics aren't polytheists. And can we at least talk about it? Can we?
Yeah.
Wasn't it not valid to talk about if someone has a higher fealty to a religious system than to the Constitution of the United States? Shouldn't you know that? I mean, let's just be open about it, okay? You know, but we can't do that anymore.
Well, we're just being mean.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, well, you know, at least somebody ought to at least explain to these guys what the difference is and why we think there's a difference.
Yeah, and they don't seem to know. I mean,
they're
I heard Rush talking about it.
Utterly clueless. They just think, you know.
Well, I think there are some differences. Don't really know much about
it. Well, didn't they run some movie the other night about, you know, Mountain Meadows Massacre
and the Mormons
killed a bunch of people a long, long time ago.
And how is that, and how's that relevant
now? They have a bunch of wives and they're polygamists and that's the only thing there is. And it's like, no.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, but how did I jump over that one? Oh, the complete elasticity of the term evangelical. I guess, would there be anybody who would really have, would really freak out if you started calling Mormons evangelicals? I mean, Erdmans is publishing books by BYU professors, and so, you know, that's why I use the term post-evangelical. We are past the point where evangelical has any meaning to it any longer. And hence, we should probably, you know, abandon the use of the term. But anyways, I still consider myself an evangelical, but no longer a Protestant. I do think I have a better understanding of what sometimes the Catholic Church is trying to convey. Now, I just stop a minute and go, trying to convey? Isn't this the infallible church? Isn't this the very mechanism that you need to interpret the Bible? And it's sometimes trying to convey? That's... You know, I have been listening to Roman Catholic apologists for 20 years now, trying to make their argument that you can't interpret the Bible without the inspired, God-ordained interpreter. I don't recall them using the trying to convey argument very, very much. But anyway, then he says, Protestants often misunderstand. Well, you know what? Protestants often do misunderstand. No question about it. I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean that there are no Protestants who understand? Or is it just simply a statement that there are misconceptions on the basis of Protestants? Well, there are. Is Dr. Beck was saying that he was one of them that had misconceptions about what? We're not told. Here's where it gets interesting. The issue of justification was key for me. Okay. The Catholic Church frames the Christian life as one in which you must exercise virtue. Not because virtue saves you, but because that's the way God's grace gets manifested. As an evangelical, even when I talked about sanctification and wanted to practice it, it seemed as if I didn't have a good enough incentive to do so. Now, there's a kind of theological framework, and it doesn't say my salvation depends on me, but it says that my virtue counts for something. It's important to allow the grace of God to be exercised through your actions. The evangelical emphasis on the moral life forms my Catholic practice with an added incentive. That was liberating to me. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. I don't know. I think it's somewhat illuminated by the next paragraph. Some of the people who have been critical say you've gone into the oppressive works system of Catholicism. That's probably somewhat a reference to me. I certainly have talked about the endless sacramental system and things like that. That's not the way I look at it at all. I look at it as a chance to do good. My own work apart from God's grace doesn't matter for my salvation. What matters is the sort of person I become by allowing God's grace to work through my obeying his commandments and taking the sacraments. Unfortunately, the view of justification is sometimes presented clumsily by some Catholic lay people. Now, again, I have a feeling that we're going to be dwelling in the Hahnian middle ground here. I'm pretty certain that this is what's being advocated here. But I look at it as a chance to do good. My own work, apart from God's grace, doesn't matter for my salvation. Now, of course, Council of Trent anathematized anyone who would say you can be saved apart from grace. They anathematized anyone who would say you can be saved apart from grace. And ever since this program started, since 1987, so about 20 years, I've been repeating the same thing over and over and over and over again. And obviously we have a small audience, and therefore the message is still not getting through to folks, so we have to repeat it over and over again because people need to understand this. The issue has never, ever, ever been the necessity of God's grace. I mean, people hear what Dr. Beckwith says there, when it says, my own work apart from God's grace doesn't matter for my salvation. What matters is the sort of person I become by allowing God's grace to work through my obeying his commandments and taking the sacraments. And they go, oh, look, he believes in the necessity of grace. See, I know Roman Catholic apologists who emphasize their belief in sola gratia, grace alone. Even my obedience is prompted by grace and the grace of the sacraments. And I've seen so many quote unquote evangelicals go, oh man, I didn't know that. I thought Roman Catholics just believed you just pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. I thought they were just a bunch of Pelagians, if they have any idea what Pelagianism is. But that's never been the case. Anyone who can think that has ever been the case has never, ever, ever read almost anything from the time of the Reformation. They haven't read Calvin. They haven't read Luther. They haven't read any of the polemics. They haven't read Calvin's response to Sadoleto or Sadoleto's letter. None of that stuff. They just don't have any concept of what the Reformation was about. The issue is not the necessity of grace. Even the Mormons say you've got to have grace. Even the Book of Mormon says that you know, grace meets you when you put out complete effort. Of course, no one puts out a complete effort, so it's still a Mission Impossible salvation plan, but you still got to have grace. The Mormons talk about grace, and the Catholics, everybody talks about grace unless you're just a full-blown Pelagian, and there aren't too many of them running around. That's never been the issue. It will never be the issue. The dividing line, to utilize the name of our own program, the dividing line is not the necessity of grace, it is the sufficiency of grace. And that's where what Dr. Beckwith just said clearly places him firmly against the Reformation and firmly in denial of... Now, see, the thing is, I don't have any evidence that Dr. Beckwith has ever believed in the sufficiency of grace. So, if he... at 14, left the Roman Catholic Communion, but went into a form of quote-unquote Protestantism that itself did not believe in the sufficiency of grace, then on this matter, he actually hasn't made any move. He actually hasn't made any move. I mean, we really need to start thinking along these lines, folks, because remember the first questions that I asked, the very first thing I said to Dave Hunt when we had our debate on KPXQ years and years ago? I said, hey, Dave, you and I... we've debated more Roman Catholics than probably any other two people living today. And yet, when it comes to the grace of God and the will of man, and if you didn't hear the grace of God and the will of man and what I just read in that paragraph from Beckwith, then your tuning fork needs to be adjusted. You're not hearing where the key issues are here. I said, in reference to the grace of God and the will of man, you would agree with Rome against the reformers. And that's when we got the, well, James, I've never read the Reformers. I just want to go with the Bible, blah, blah, blah stuff. We know what became of that. But that is the dividing line. That was the dividing line then. Now, that line has moved way over into Protestantism, into what's called Protestantism. But it's still the dividing line. It hasn't changed. The issue is the sufficiency of grace. Can God save a sinner by himself to his own glory? Or has God designed this work called the gospel, this thing called the gospel, in such a way that the only way that it works is synergistically, so that man has to cooperate and then God gets the glory because man utilized the grace and so on and so forth? Is that how it works? That's the dividing line. The reformers said, no, God's grace is sufficient. It is necessary and sufficient. And Rome says it is necessary, but not sufficient in and of itself. There has to be these other things. And so when someone says, you know, my own work apart from God's grace doesn't matter for my salvation, people go, oh, that's wonderful. But the real question needs to be asked is God's grace sufficient in and of itself for your salvation? And evidently, when he starts talking about my obeying his commandments and taking the sacraments, Dr. Beckwith is a good Roman Catholic now. But was he ever anything other than that is the question that I would ask. I don't know. His writings are not really in that area, and so I don't know. I can't answer that question. Can someone point me to published works where he affirmed the sufficiency of grace, that God can save perfectly without human cooperation? Or that, I guess the better way to put that is that God's work of salvation produces that human cooperation, but it's not some secondary thing that's upon which the entire work of God is dependent. I don't know. I don't know where he was. I don't get the feeling, because as he himself says, his work has always been Catholic friendly. Has always been friendly toward Catholic theology and things like that, and that's a fundamental difference, is whether you believe in a sacramental grace mediated through the sacraments and, you know, the repetitious sacrifice, the mass that perfects no one, and all the rest of these things. And so when he says, unfortunately, the view of justification is sometimes presented clumsily by some Catholic lay people, well, yeah, but why? I keep hearing these caveats, this wiggle room being created. And so I'm really wondering what's coming. You know, is this going to be a Tridentine doctrine of justification, or are we going to try to go with some, you know, more ecumenical, modern, you know, he mentions the accord on justification, but that's not dogmatic. That's not from an ecumenical council. So are we going into the more wishy-washy, you know, scholarly Roman Catholicism that redefines all the terms in a way that's totally different than they've been defined in the past? I don't know. We will just have to see. But there was another line down here. My eyes just fell upon it. I wanted to mention it. Much of Christian theology that we assume to be true, key doctrines such as the Trinity and the deity of Christ, were thought out quite a while ago through rigorous arguments and analysis and debate. Well, actually, they were a whole lot different than that. I was listening today, and I need to blog this. I was listening today to a friend of mine, Nick Needham, and his lectures on Athanasius. Dr. Needham, I quoted him on the blog recently, and he has some great lectures on the Wicket Gate website. And I was listening to his lectures on Athanasius this morning while getting in about a 30-mile ride, and I even got quoted. I almost fell off my bike. I was one of the last people he quoted. I was like, hey, cool. And he said I'd been there about a month ago, so at least gives me some idea of he's up in Inverness. But anyway, he was talking about Athanasius, and of course Athanasius is just this wonderful example. I mean, talk about the deity of Christ and the Trinity and the issues surrounding Athanasius is key in those situations. And of course, he did an excellent job in narrating the events of the Arian ascendancy that took place after the Council of Nicaea. And I could not help but think how many of the events that took place during the period of time from 325 to, say, 380, 385, so many things took place there that are so utterly opposed to the Roman Catholic concept of ecclesiology and ecumenical councils and their authority and issues like that. But he was talking about how the Arians once again, you know, took over power, and how the Nicene faith had to fight for itself. And it wasn't because, you know, well, the church has decided these things. Well, no, that's not how anybody thought back then. And yet so many Roman Catholics today, that's exactly how they do think, is that, well, you know, once Nicaea spoke, you know, and the Pope ratified it, that was it, right? Well, no, that wasn't it. And that just shows that they didn't think the way that modern Roman Catholics think today. But the Trinity and the deity of Christ are biblical doctrines. He says, right here, he says, look, you're not going to come up with the Nicene Creed by just picking up the Bible. Well, if by what he means by that is that the Nicene Creed grew out of a historical situation and the need to utilize specific language, the homoousian clause, to be able to identify Arians and to reject their infiltration of the church, if that's what he means, which I don't think is what he means, but that would be the only way that I could take that statement and make any sense out of it. But if what he means by that is that the Nicene Creed is a further revelation, that it is it has authority beyond that of Scripture, or if he's saying that you cannot demonstrate the doctrine of the Trinity from the Scripture without the infallible Church and all the rest of that type of stuff, that's, as people who know me well know, that's one of my truly pet peeves. If you want to hear, I think, one of the most blasphemous statements ever made, I blogged it recently with one of the videos, when Jerry Matatix said that we have the exact same warrant and authority for our belief in the bodily assumption of Mary that we have for the resurrection of Christ, because both are simply dependent upon the church. And when I hear people going there, it's hard for me to control myself, because to even suggest that the biblical foundations of such unbiblical, ahistorical, man-made concepts as the Marian dogmas or papal infallibility and things like that are in any way equal to or even similar to the biblical evidence for the divine truth of who God is, of the doctrine of the Trinity, the person of the deity of Christ, the person, deity of the Holy Spirit. Oh, I would never want to have to stand before a holy God and defend such utter blasphemy as that. Oh my goodness. God just has to turn you over for you to be able to say something like, oh my goodness, that's just, And so, I certainly hope that's not what's being said there, but it says, evangelicals kid themselves when they believe that they can reinvent the wheel with every generation, that you have to produce another spate of systematic theology textbooks to teach people the stuff that has already been articulated for generations. Well, again, I don't know who these evangelicals are, but I remember specifically, it's in the Roman Catholic controversy, it's in Scripture alone, but the reinventing the wheel argument is one of the things that I refute in every time that I speak or write on the subject of sola scriptura. And that comes straight out of, you know, Mark Shea and Steve Ray and these guys that repeat that kind of thing all the time. So it will be interesting to see. It'll be very, very interesting to see what comes out. 877-753-3341. I've made numerous statements about Roman Catholicism so far. And if I'm to believe a tenth of what I read about myself on the web, then 90% of what I've said has to be completely fallacious, and I'm just not sure why some of these folks, you know, some of them are attorneys. Why aren't they on the line right now just demonstrating that everything I've said is wrong and that this isn't what the Roman Catholic Church teaches, and the Church doesn't teach that that the Mass is a representation of the sacrifice of Christ, I wonder why that phone is my interface working here? I see idle all the way down. Okay, all right, well, just checking. There's a lot of folks that are really brave behind keyboards, but when it comes to an opportunity of demonstrating that don't know what I'm talking about, we don't get any phone calls. Very, very odd. But anyway, so that's... oh, and by the way, one other thing here. Let me refresh this screen to see if there's been any additions since I last took a look at it. No, it doesn't look like there has been. There is a... a day of fasting for my conversion to Roman Catholicism tomorrow. I've been looking at the thread at Catholic Answers, and there's this one fellow, and I posted this number on his blog a couple of days ago, and he uses the name Montana Man on the Catholic Answers forums, and he says, "But I can understand White's reaction aside from the problem of his titanic ego. This thread is provocative. A normal person would probably take it as condescending. Still, all in all, JW just adds the perception of arrogance when he feels the need to address every comment about him on the internet." Well, if I tried to address every comment about me on the internet, I would never sleep nor eat because, you know, and again, each one of these groups thinks that they are the center of the universe. You know, that they are the only ones that we're dealing with. I'm spending most of my time on Islam right now. Sometimes, you know, I get drawn into a textual critical issue, and sometimes it's a, you know, a Jehovah's Witness issue, and I'm writing a review about a Mormon book on Islam for the CRI Journal, and I'm teaching through the Synoptic Gospels at church, and I just don't. I'm not one of those folks who lives in one topic and one area all the time, but these folks really seem to think that's it. And, you know, the only thing that's, you know, I've got this Google homepage now that I go to, and I've got I'm now using the Google RSS reader. Gotta admit, it's the best thing I've ever run into. I can use it on my BlackBerry. And it's really, really nice. I mean, it works well. Let's face it, when something works like that, that's what you're going to use. And I put a little widget thingy, or whatever you call them, on the homepage that uses the Google blog search thing for my name, just so I see stuff come up. And it gets all sorts of weird stuff that's not at all relevant to me, but it also does a pretty good job catching stuff. And a bunch of folks just all angry at me because I dared to... to ask some simple questions on a blog. I didn't even look at who had written it. I just looked at what was said. It was completely unfair. It was completely biased. It was completely prejudiced. I just asked some questions. Well, it was a girl, and she's young, and you're mean. It's like, you know, if I had been mean to her, that would be one thing, but I asked simple, factual questions. If you're going to put stuff on the internet and use people's names, they're going to find it. You know, Google is everywhere. It's the beginning of Skynet. they just missed Skynet a little bit. It's going to be GoogleNet or something like that. That's eventually going to, I get hits on the basketball player. I've seen stuff about how I can dunk a ball better than anybody else can and stuff like that. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. My vertical is about that of a credit card, but on its side. But anyway. white men can't jump. Well, I can. I actually have got very strong calves, so I can jump a little bit. But that's as far as that goes. Anyhow, I'm not getting very far on that one. I do have, believe it or not, I have the Shabir Ali stuff queued up, and so we'll be going to that in just a moment. But first, we actually have gotten a phone call. We'll see if we can handle this question. Let's Race. Okay.
Yeah, my father was a big Johnny Quest fan, and I guess there's an individual on there that I was named after. So
really, I remember seeing that, but I don't remember anyone named Race. But hey, you know what? I was pretty young, so what can we do for you, Race?
Well, I'm a long-time listener, and I really appreciate you taking my call, and I don't anticipate any Catholics calling in, so I figured...
You don't? Oh, come on. they're just having a problem with the long number at the moment,
yeah,
I guess.
Maybe.
It's not an 800 number, so they're a little afraid it's really not toll-free. It is toll-free, folks. It really is. But anyway.
But my question is, I'm doing a study on divorce and remarriage, and one of my questions is based on Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 19.
Mm-hmm.
And in verse 7, I came across a booklet, and it was highlighting, it was basically saying that the Greek in Matthew 19:7, the words that are used for divorce there, apostasio and apolusai.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the argument says, well, he uses divorce and send her away in 7, but then when you get to 8, this gentleman's argument was the King James mistranslated 19:8, and instead of using what was translated as divorce in 19:7, it used apolusai, which means to send away. So mm-hmm. basically, the argument centered around the idea that it's not actually talking about divorce, but actually sending someone away, and why it's wrong for them, or why it's adultery for them to have. It's the reason it's adultery is because they were never divorced, because that's not what the term is insinuating. It's actually insinuating sending her away.
Okay, well, haven't ever, I don't claim any particular expertise in this particular field, that is the divorce and remarriage issue, but the first term that is used, that is translated as certificate of divorce, is a very specific term. Apolusai is in a verbal form. It's a infinitive, an aorist infinitive. And so in the next verse, when it says permitted you, that term permitted is very frequently followed by an infinitive. And so it'd be more natural to use the infinitival form, apolusai. It just flows naturally when it says, because the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to apolusai, tas gunaikos humon, to release or divorce your wives. The New American Standard says divorce. Let me see here. The ESV says divorce, and that seems to be standard translation. You'd have to come up with a means of demonstrating that in verse 7 that the apolusai there has a different meaning than divorce, and that I don't think you can come up with that kind of a defense. Mm-hmm. And it just seems much more natural in verse 8 to use the infinitive there than to say, because the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to, write a certificate of divorce, or just repeat what you had just said earlier. I outside of that, I don't know what other commentary I could provide to you, because okay. It's not something that I've spent any time on.
I couldn't even find any argumentation. I mean, it was never anything that any other commentary even brought up as far as an argumentation. And like I said, this booklet that I was reading, it just said because there was two different words used in 7, one for divorce and the other one for send away.
Yes, yeah, that's just assuming that. Because it says give her a certificate of divorce, which was a written thing, and to send her away, which would mean the separation, that somehow those are two different things, and that uh-huh. they're not referring. That's where the assumptions. Could I just ask who the author is?
His name is Denny Coburn. I don't know. Probably never heard of him.
Yeah, no, it doesn't ring any bells. I thought it might. But, yeah, that's where that's the problematic aspect of it right there, is it's sort of assuming its own conclusion at that particular point, as far as I can look at it. But I'm not one of those folks that claims to be an expert on all things, and I would have to do a whole lot more looking at it to give you much more information than that.
Okay, well,
by the way, we did find out Race Bannon is the fellow.
That's him.
Yeah, Roger Race Bannon, the white-haired guy on Johnny Quest. There you go. So
actually, I've never watched a show a day in my life, even though he is my namesake. So
well, you should. It wasn't, as I recall, it wasn't too bad of a program. So
well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Race.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. 877-753-3341 is the phone number for the program today. and have plenty of lines open for all of you who'd like to, you know, stand behind your words. But how many times have we done this in the past and sat there staring at those phone lines and they are just really quiet? All right, let's move on then. Though you can call anytime, you know, if you're just getting up the courage, you know, we're going to be on for another 25 minutes. But, well, if you call 24 minutes from now, you're going to be missing things. But go back to something that we had actually begun quite some time ago, and that is I was playing a debate that took place in the year 2004. Between Mike Lycona and Shabir Ali. This took place up at Regent University, and Virginia Beach, Virginia. And we were listening to Shabir Ali's presentation. I honestly lost where I put the date at the point in time where I was. I don't know where it went. I saved it in a program somewhere, and we'll find it, you know, a few weeks from now or, you know, a few years from now. I'll find this odd note in a text somewhere. It says Shabir Ali, Regent 30 dot 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 dot. You know, that's sort of how it works. So I'm going to pick it up sort of here. It's toward the end of his presentation, and then we're going to go into the Q&A section where they're actually going back and forth. And what had happened is, you may recall, I took some time to look at some common objections that really dovetail right in with what Shabir Ali is saying. I played some of that on the program, and now we go back to Shabir Ali's comments.
Every single bone of it. But if we take just the narratives the way they are given in the text, one would not be sure that Jesus actually died on the cross. The second point that I wanted to make about this is that in reading the narratives, I could not be persuaded that they actually saw Jesus back from the dead. Now, of course, when you read the narratives today, you see that there are many, including the Gospel according to John, in which there are at least three. But when you comb back past through these narratives and you look at the evolution of the text over time, you realize that the later Gospels are improving the story for you. So in Mark's Gospel, you do not have any actual narrative showing that Jesus reappeared to his disciples, except in an ending which is known today to not be originally from Mark. It's a later addition into his Gospel.
Now that, of course, came up in our debate in Biola last year in regards to Mark 16:9-20. And don't you find it so very strange that Mark's Gospel ends in this way? But, you know, when you think about it, I've given some thought to that since then, and it is interesting in light of a book I've recommended to your reading, entitled Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Baucom, who develops very fully, sometimes more fully than most people can read, I think, develops very fully the idea that there is a fundamental flaw in the very common view that people have in New Testament studies today, that you basically have the ministry of Jesus, and then you have these decades of silence, and then you have the Gospels cropping up, you know, decades down the road. And the flaw that is not being understood is that Christians weren't just sitting around doing nothing. There was continuous preaching, and within that context, you had the eyewitnesses. The eyewitnesses are continuing their proclamation. Therefore, the idea that there's this massive amount of redaction, evolution, creation, change, would fly in the face of the continuing presence of the eyewitnesses. And I find it interesting to note that I don't believe that a Muslim would be able to argue very consistently against Baucom's thesis. Because, in essence, they are dependent upon the very same kind of concept in their own theology, in that the Qura, the readers, those who had memorized the Quran orally, were very, very important in the protection of that text and the transmission of that text up to the Uthmanic revision. So they couldn't possibly argue that eyewitnesses are not tremendously important. They are. And yet this is missing in Shabir as well. You know, you've got they're improving and so on. So well, if they were improving in the sense of changing something, then the eyewitnesses that what they produced would then contradict what the eyewitnesses themselves said. See, and so this idea that you have this silent period and there's all this development and evolution going on, all the rest of this stuff, just flies in the face of reality and truth itself, but it's the presentation that's being made.
Then you go to the later Gospels of Matthew and Luke, and you can see that right before your eyes, the stories are being improved. And that tells us that over time, as the stories were told and retold, they took on certain improvements.
See that right there, the stories are told and retold. This idea of an oral tradition that gets warped and changed over time is contradictory to the fact that you have eyewitnesses in the apostolic church up the point of inscripturation. You have to get rid of them for this to work, no matter how popular it might be to present things in this way.
To become what they are now. So now, when we think about what happened, we can be quite convinced that Jesus died because we're reading them all together, putting them all together in our minds. When we read the Gospels about the reappearance of Jesus from the dead, we are reading all of them together and thinking that all of these details are true. But what scholars have noted is that, in fact, these stories have evolved over time. So if you have, for example, in Luke's Gospel, Jesus appearing to his 12 disciples, or rather 11, because the one had betrayed him on the day of Easter, John has the dramatic reappearance of Jesus a week later, so that he can appear to Thomas, and the doubting Thomas can verify that Jesus is here for real. But in order for John to do that, he had to make Thomas absent on the first occasion. So that whereas Luke has him appearing to all of his disciples, the 11, John says Thomas was absent.
So see the assumptions that are being made. The assumption that is, of course, being made by Shabir here is that, well, it was Luke's intention to give us an absolutely exhaustive account of every meeting. Well, of course, but Luke doesn't even try to do that, so I'm not sure why I would assume that. Oh, I would assume that because I'm using critical scholarship that assumes the errors of these things, and that's not the kind of critical scholarship he uses when he looks at the Quran, so there's a contradiction there. But, yeah, that's sort of how it looks. And that's what the phone call, I guess, we have right now is about, is Shabir's use of sources. So let's sneak it in there as we continue. Let's talk with Johnny. Hi, Johnny.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Good, good. I was calling because in liberal scholars, and I do remember you mentioning that liberal scholars tend to have a smaller canon of Paul's corpus.
Yes.
Of about 7 books or something like that. So it makes me wonder because 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse, I believe, 18, makes a direct quotation to Luke chapter 10, verse 7, where it says that an employee is worth his wages, something
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's Pauline or if they accept it, because I don't know, as being from the time of Paul, would that not prove that Luke's gospel is much earlier than what they are suggesting?
Excellent question. I'm afraid most folks may not have followed it, so let me lay it out for folks. In 1 Timothy 5:18, where the scripture says, "You shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing," which is a citation from Deuteronomy 25. But then the laborer is worthy of his wages, is actually found in Luke, chapter 10. And, so the point, being, that the individual making the arguments that Shabir Ali is making might be challenged by the fact that, well, if 1 Timothy 5 is Pauline and this is making reference to Luke, then you can't put Luke way back in the 70s or 80s because Paul's already croaked by then, okay? He's dead. His death is normally placed within the context of somewhere around the very beginning of the 7th decade, that is the early 60s. And so if that's the case, then Luke would have to pre-exist that. Well, a couple things before I address what the liberals would say at that point. From our own perspective, a conservative perspective, some might say, and in fact, I think we would have to consider the fact that Luke utilizes sources, and that what this would, you could understand this to mean is that Paul doesn't necessarily have the entire Luke and Corpus in front of him, but that Luke has been gathering these things together, and Paul would have a knowledge of everything that Luke has. Now, that doesn't really change the argument any, because that still means that Luke is doing his collation and his and things like that during Paul's life. And I think that's an important point to make, is that I think there's really good reason to believe that Luke Acts is written by Luke as sort of an amicus brief, a documentation of the fact that this religion that Paul is being accused of presenting in the Roman Empire, that is opposed to Caesar and opposed to the Roman government, isn't that. And here's the documentation. Here's the story of who this Jesus was. Here's what Paul has done. Here's what the early church is. And the only reason that Luke would ever have to write that is before Paul's death. That still, no matter what, puts Luke doing this work in the 6th century, within 30 years of the events themselves, and that is obviously during the period of time when the eyewitnesses, which is the very term that Luke uses in Luke chapter 1, are still alive. Yeah, exactly. The end of the 50s. So, you know, 25, 30 years at most, because, you know, if Paul's arrested, you know, around the 60s, somewhere in there, then you're talking, you know, 30, 27 years around in that time period. Now, what the liberal is going to say, which you can probably guess, is that no, 1st, 2nd Timothy, Colossians, Ephesians, these are not Pauline. They are much later, 70s and 80s, and so they can reflect a knowledge of 70s and 80s materials that would be in Luke, and hence they would say, oh, no, this is much later. They can't give you any documentation. It's all theoretical based upon certain paradigms, but, yeah, they would reject the Pauline authorship, and I'm pretty certain that Shabir would say, well, scholars say. You know, that's his modus operandi. You can find a scholar somewhere who has said anything about anything in the New Testament. Whether that scholar is consistent or whether that scholar is, you know, really meaningful at all doesn't matter. I mean, we saw that when Shabir tried to make the Gospel of Thomas earlier than the Gospel of Mark. Find one massive leftist liberal woman at Boston College, and now scholars have said that. See, well, serious. That's where she's from. That's, you know, you looked up the source, and that's where it came from. So, I'm pretty certain that he would raise the issue that, well, you know, we don't know that 1st, 2nd Timothy is actually Pauline, and so we can't really date it. Blah 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 blah. In that way, yeah, most definitely.
James, by the way, I just wanted to ask you, because I listened that you had played a clip of the debate between William Lane Craig and Bart Ehrman, and I haven't been able to find the audio. Do you know what website I can go to get it?
It was sent to me, and so I do not know. I would imagine if you go to William Lane Craig's website, you've got to get it through William. I do know this much. You have to get it through William Lane Craig, because as far as I can tell, Ehrman isn't making it available for some reason. I've heard that there were some issues, but go to William Lane Craig's home page, and you should be able to pull it up from there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling. All right, God bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. Still time. There's still time out there for all my Roman Catholic friends to provide all that documentation that just must be so easily obtained, because I've deceived so many people, and we'll go from there. But Tell those phone calls start flooding in, which I'm sure they will. We go back to the debate.
This leaves the opening for Jesus to come back a week later and appear to the doubting Thomas. So when we read the stories, we see then that the gospel writers themselves have improved the stories. And if we are...
Or if we assume a certain paradigm, we assume a certain background, then we can squish the gospels into our paradigm and our background and make them that way.
To peel back the improvements and study the text historically, we could not be convinced that Jesus actually died on the cross and also reappeared to his disciples in a physical, bodily form. Those historians who agree that he died are agreeing what historians would normally agree with. If somebody lived 2,000 years ago and is no longer with us, then he is dead, according to the rules of history. But If someone claims that he reappeared to his disciples in a physical bodily form, such as to lead to the conclusion that he resurrected from the dead, then we should be asking two questions. Was he really dead? Examining the narratives does not persuade me that he was actually dead on the cross. And second,
Examining the narrative. Wait a minute. What if I said, examining the text of the Quran does not convince me that Muhammad denied the crucifixion? Now, he would say, but Surah 4:157 says, yeah, but I can give you all sorts of differing ways of reading Surah 4:157. I can argue that Surah 4:157 is actually saying it's just the Jews that didn't crucify him, it was the Romans that crucified him, and I can give you all sorts of stuff like that, but how on earth can you read these narratives without beginning with the assumption of their completely evolutionary character and nature? And the most left-wing, far-out theories, is it not obvious that every single one of the sources, whether it's the tradition that you find in 1 Corinthians 15 that goes back to the very beginning, whether it's Paul, Peter, John. Remember, for Shabir Ali, Paul is the originator of what's called Christianity today, and all of the Gospels are just basically retreads of Paul. The original followers of Jesus lost. They lost. They could not stand up against the great persuasive power of Paul for some reason. But all these narratives say the same thing. They all say Jesus died, was buried, and rose again. The very language that they use, anastasis, the stuff in the tomb book that I presented at the end, very relevant to this, very, very relevant to this particular aspect of it as well.
Narratives, peeling back the later layers of improvements does not persuade me that he actually reappeared to his disciples in a physical, bodily form. Now, Muslims and Christians can still believe that Jesus was raised up by God. But that, of course, is something that we cannot prove. And even though I believe that, it is not something I'm here to demonstrate and prove. Thank you very much.
Whatever raised up by God means. Now, let me make a comment about this debate. You're going to hear the moderator here. Let me tell you something. I could never do a debate in this context. It was the super laid back, sort of like, you know, when we first got to the debate and there were the bring out the comfy chairs and the flowers and we're just going to have ourselves a nice little discussion. No, we're not. We're going to have a debate and I need to have a place to write and he's going to need a place to write and we're going to do a debate here. We're not going to sit here and sip Starbucks and do this kind of, but that's sort of what happened here. Let's listen.
As we mentioned earlier, we're not doing a formal debate, and we're going to enter into something that's somewhat creative in regards to debate. We're picking up something from television. Crossfire is a title anyway. And our next 15 minutes will involve Mike asking questions of Shabir, and then we'll exchange that and go back and forth a couple of times, and I think you'll find this interesting.
How you doing, Shabir?
Pretty good, Mike.
It's really great to meet you today. Let's see, you started off, but let me go with what you said last here about the developing legend within the Gospels. You spent some time talking about how the traditions of the resurrection narratives had developed embellishments over time and there were some legendary additions and so forth, and so therefore we shouldn't believe the accounts at all. In my opening speech tonight, I was pretty careful to discuss evidence that predates the Gospels by decades. In fact, stuff which is goes back to the original disciples themselves. And so,
now let me just mention so people understand what's being said here. Obviously, it was Mike Lycona's decision and approach to try to avoid all the Gospel stuff that Shabir does all the time saying, look, let's not worry about the Gospels. Remember, we addressed this in the program. This tradition that is found in Paul's writings goes back to within, you know, months of the crucifixion itself, especially 1 Corinthians 15, 1-5. So I understand that. So what he's saying is, I'm looking at that, not the date of the writing of the Gospels. Because one of the problems I have here is that the tradition, the material that's in the Gospels is just as old. And I think one of the places where they sort of, you know, passed like ships in the night a little bit was not making that really clear, is that we're talking about the origination of the tradition that eventually gets written down in Paul's letters, which is previous to the Gospels, or at least we're assuming that, or, you know, I would put actually Mark before some of those things. But that's where I think some confusion came in this particular section.
Even I think the Gospels are reliable, but let's just say for a moment, in fact, I'd be happy for the remainder of our debate this evening to just concede for the sake of argument. The Gospels are filled with errors and contradictions, we'll say.
That's going to come back to bite them. That's where I would go. Nope, you know, sorry. I understand the approach, but you just can't go that direction. That's where I get off the boat at that point and say, no, you don't admit that and then or grant that and then try to come back to rescue that. And you'll see by the end of the debate that he's having to come back to that by that point, and it's too late. You can't really do that.
How does that impact the evidence that I provided, which, again, comes decades earlier? I mean, it seems to me that what happened is you're assaulting this hill and you're throwing grenades and we're seeing explosions, but I'm on this other hill and I'm saying, what's he doing over there? My army's on this hill. And how would you respond to that?
Well, the evidence which you have cited showing that there was an early acknowledgement that Jesus reappeared to his disciples is not something that historians deny, or that what I have presented denies. You have evidence that there was a blossoming Christian faith. People believe that Jesus is alive. Muslims believe that Jesus is alive. But the belief that someone is alive and in heaven with God does not necessitate his bodily resurrection. In the Gospels themselves, you have it that Jesus proclaims that Abraham and Moses are alive. They're alive with God. But the belief that they're alive does not necessitate their bodily resurrection. So it is quite possible that the disciples of Jesus, witnessing the crucifixion event, later on came to the conclusion, for whatever reason, that God raised Jesus from the dead. And that conclusion does not necessitate finding his tomb empty and knowing that he physically, bodily resurrected from the dead.
Even though that's what every single one of them said in every possible way they could say, and that all the sources that can be traced that time period. Remember, Shabir will allow the use of sources that cannot be traced that time period, and will give them far more weight than they deserve, sort of like the tomb folks using the Acts of Philip, that all the sources from that time period themselves likewise say the same thing, and that this was a real resurrection, not just some spiritual sighting of Jesus or something along those lines. So that's what we're going to have to pick up the next time we can do The Dividing Line. Now, we did do a British Dividing Line once, and so I'll have to see if we can't possibly arrange one for Thursday, maybe. We may have to play with the time and stuff, but we'll see if we can work something out, maybe do something from over there. That would be interesting to do. Otherwise, 29th of May, we'll let you know on the blog. Thanks for listening. God bless.
Day. It's a sin.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.